Without their uniforms, numbers, and distinctive accessories, they were interchangeable, hard even for me to identify, having gotten so used to seeing them in their prison garb. Remember, in 1971 there was hair everywhere, shoulder-length hair and long sideburns on most of the students in both categories, some of whom had full mustaches as well. The joint session was, in the words of one former prisoner, stiffly polite, compared to the more relaxed and friendly prisoner's session. As each was scoping out the others, one prisoner asked whether some recruits had been selected to be guards because they were taller. Jerry, 5486, said, "I had the feeling somewhere along the study that the guards were bigger than the prisoners, and I wonder if the average height of the guards is higher than the average height of the prisoners. I don't know if that's true or not, nor if that was my perception because of the uniforms." Before I answered no, I asked all the students to line up in order of their height, from tallest to shortest. There was an almost perfect height match between the guards on one side and the prisoners on the other. What became evident is that the prisoners had come to perceive the guards as taller than they actually were, as though their guard power provided them with a 2-inch shoe lift. There were not any direct confrontations between abused prisoners and abusing guards, as I had anticipated there might be. In part, this was because such personal challenges would have been awkward in a group of more than 20 people. It is likely, however, that what remained of the strong emotions felt by some of the former prisoners had to be consciously suppressed now that the power grid had been deactivated. It also helped that a few of the guards openly apologized for submerging themselves too deeply into their role and taking it too seriously. Their apologies eased the tension and stood as proxy for the tougher guards who did not apologize openly, like Hellman. At this debriefing session, former tough guard Arnett, our sociology graduate student, recounted two events that had impressed him. One was Imbardo's observation of prisoners' immersion in their inmate roles, expressed by people staying inmates even when they said they'd give up their payment if they could be released, paroled. The other impression is the seeming inability of former prisoners at the meeting to believe that John Wayne and I, and perhaps other guards, I felt that we were the two most disliked guards, had been completely acting in our roles. Some or many prisoners seemed to feel that we were actually sadistic or extremely authoritarian people and that our professions of acting were cover-ups to hide the real nature of our behavior from them, or ourselves, or both. I'm absolutely sure that, for myself at least, this was not the case. One psychological observation that I offered was about the lack of humor in our prison and the failure to use humor to diffuse tension, or even to bring some reality to an unreal situation. For example, guards who were not pleased with the extreme behavior of their shiftmates could have made a joke at their expense in guard quarters, saying that they should be getting double pay for overacting their role. Or the prisoners might have used humor to pull themselves out of the unreal basement jail by asking the guards what this place had been used for before it became a jail. A pigsty? Or a frat house, maybe? Humor breaks through the pretensions of person and place. However, in the past week there had been none to be found in this sad place. Before we adjourned, I asked them all to be sure they had completed their final evaluations of the experience they had undergone and to complete some other forms that Kurt Banks had available. I also invited them to write a short retrospective diary of the events that stood out in their memory during the following month. They would get a fee for doing so. Finally, they would all be invited back in a few weeks for a Class of 1971 reunion to review some of the data we had gathered. A slideshow and video clips would be available. It should be added that I maintained contact with many of the participants over a number of years, all of them through correspondence whenever there was a publication or media show of the study. In addition, some of them participated in various television programs that featured our study for decades after this experience, a few even to this day. We will discuss the after effects of this experience on them later on. What does it mean to be a prisoner or a guard? Before we turn in the next chapter to examining some of the objective data we collected over the 6 days of study, and to reflect on the serious ethical issues raised by the experiment, I think it would be useful to review some of the insights we gathered from a selection of our participants. On being in the role of prisoner. Clay, 416. A good prisoner is one who knows how to strategically unify himself with other prisoners without getting put out of action himself. My cellmate, Jerry, 5486, is a good prisoner. There are always bound to be some prisoners struggling to get out and others who are not at that point. Those who are not struggling at the time should learn to protect their interests without being a real obstacle to those who are struggling. A bad prisoner is one who cannot do this, who is only out for himself. Jerry, 5486. The most apparent thing that I noticed was how most of the people in this study derive their sense of identity and well-being from their immediate surroundings, rather than from within themselves, and that's why they broke down. Just couldn't stand the pressure. They had nothing within them to hold up against all of this. Paul, 5704. The way we had to degrade ourselves really brought me down, and that's why we all got docile towards the end of the experiment. I gave up being a reactionary because I could see nothing was being changed by my attitude and behavior. After Stu and Rich, 819 and 1037, left, I found myself thinking that I couldn't change everything that needed changing myself. That's another reason I settled down after they left. To accomplish what I wanted, I would have needed others to work with me. I tried to talk to the other prisoners about a strike or something, but they wanted no part of it because of the punishment they had received for the first one. Guard Arnett. I was profoundly surprised and impressed by the reactions of most of the prisoners to the experimental situation, particularly the individual breakdowns which did occur, and the impending ones which I feel surely would have happened had the experiment not been terminated when it was. Doug, 8612. The material conditions, like the guards, the cells, and such stuff, well, that didn't matter to me. Like when I was nude and in chains, that never bothered me. It was the head part, the psychological part, that was the worst. Knowing that I couldn't get out if I wanted, I didn't like not being able to go to the bathroom when I wanted to. It's not having the choice that's the tearing apart thing. Substitute prisoner Dave, 8612. Our spy, who knew that he was sent into our jail for only one day to find out about the nature of the escape plans, reveals how quickly and totally one can move into the role of prisoner. The roles were infesting everyone, from the lowliest prisoner to the warden himself. He very quickly identified himself with the prisoners, and in only a single day, the simulated imprisonment had an enormous impact on Dave. I at times felt some guilt at being sent in to think on these great guys. I was somewhat relieved that there was really nothing to tell about the escape. And when the opportunity to think did come up, I knew where the handcuff key was after a while. I didn't tell. I fell asleep that night feeling dirty, guilty, scared. When we were taken to the boiler room, in anticipation of the break-in, I had taken off my foot cuff and seriously considered trying to escape, alone, I might add, but I did not fear of getting caught. The experience of one full day as a prisoner had aroused sufficient anxiety to keep me away from the prison for the rest of the week. Even when I returned for the debriefing session, I was still feeling extremely anxious. I was not eating very much, felt mildly nauseous all the time, and was more nervous than I can ever remember being. The entire experience was so upsetting to me that I was unable to bring myself to discuss my experiences in depth with anyone, even my wife. I should add that we later discovered that the handcuff keys had been stolen from one of the guards by a prisoner. After the incident with the Wednesday night transfer of all the prisoners up to the fifth floor storage room, When they were returned to the yard at 12:30 a.m., two of the prisoners had been cuffed together to prevent their trying to escape. Without the keys to unlock them, I had to call the Stanford police to remove the cuffs, an embarrassment to say the least. One of the prisoners had thrown the key into a heating vent. David knew this, and never shared that information with any of the staff. On the Power of the Guard Roll. Guard Jeff Landry. It's almost like a prison that you create yourself. You get into it, and it's just that it becomes the definitions you make of yourself almost become walls, and you want to break out, and you want to be able to tell everyone that this isn't really me at all, and I'm a person who wants to get out and show that I'm free, and I do have my own will, and I'm not the sadistic type of person that enjoys this type of thing. Guard Varnish. This experience was worthwhile for me, absolutely. The idea that two roughly identical groups of college students, each in only a week's time, evolved into two totally disparate social groups, with one group having and utilizing total power over the other to their detriment, is chilling. I was surprised at myself. I made them call each other names and clean out toilets with their bare hands. I practically considered the prisoners cattle, and I kept thinking I have to watch out for them in case they try something. Guard Vandy. My enjoyment in harassing and punishing prisoners was quite unnatural for me, because I tend to think of myself as being sympathetic to the injured, especially animals. I think that it was an outgrowth from my total freedom to rule the prisoners. I began to abuse my authority. An interesting carryover or carry-out of this newfound guard power is revealed in Warden Jaffe's log. Vandy had reported to the others on his shift that he had caught himself bossing his mother around at home. Guard Arnett. Being superficially tough came easily to me. For one thing, I am an authoritarian person in some ways, even though I strongly dislike that trait in myself and others. Further, I felt that the experiment was important, and my being guard-like was part of finding out how people react to real oppression. The main influence on my behavior was the feeling, even though vague, that real prison is brutal in that it is dehumanizing. I tried to be that within the constraints of my detachment and controlled commitment. First, I tried to avoid ever being personal or friendly. I tried to be neutral and businesslike. Also, I was aware from my readings that the boredom and other aspects of prison life can be exploited to make people feel disoriented by being impersonal, giving boring work, punishing all prisoners for bad behavior by individuals, demanding perfect execution of trivial commands in exercise and at other times, speaking harshly and mechanically during exercise sessions, within a social setting and so very sensitive to those in control of that setting. And I tried to heighten prisoner alienation by using some of those techniques. I could do this in only a limited way because I didn't want to be brutal. On Good and Bad Guards. Paul, 5704. I was pleased with John and Jeff Landry. They didn't really get into the guard thing as much as the others. They always remained human beings, even when giving punishment to someone. I was surprised that the guards in general accepted their roles as much as they did after being able to go home each day or night. Guard John Landry. After I talked to the other prisoners, they told me I was a good guard and thanks for being that way. I knew inside I was a shit. Kurt Banks looked at me and I knew he knew. I knew also that while I was good and just to the prisoners, I failed myself. I let cruelty happen and did nothing except feel guilty and be a nice guy. I honestly didn't think I could do anything. I didn't even try. I did what most people do. I sat in the guard station and tried to forget about the prisoners. An even more remarkable testimony to the power of this simulated prison experience and its impact on one of the guards whom prisoners saw as the most fair and just, Jeff Landry, the big brother of John Landry, occurred in an audio interview at the end of the study. He surprised us by indicating that he had been thinking of switching roles. Guard Jeff Landry. The experience became more than just participating in the experiment. What I mean to say is that if this was an experiment, the results and products were almost too real. When a prisoner gives you a glassy stare and mumbles inaudibly, you just almost have to perceive the worst. It's almost because you fear that the worst will happen. It's almost as if I accepted it would happen, and the slightest indication of anxiety and breakdown is the beginning of the worst possible effects. Specifically, the experience became more than just an experiment when 1037 started acting as though he was breaking down. At this time, I was afraid and apprehensive and thought of quitting. And I also was thinking of asking to become a prisoner. I felt as though I didn't want to become part of the machine that beats down on other men and forces them to conform and continually harasses them. I almost wished that I was being harassed than having to be the harasser. In this context, it is interesting to note that on Wednesday night, this guard had reported to the warden that his shirt was too tight and was irritating his skin, so he took it off. Obviously, since he had selected it, had tried it on for fit the day before we began, and had worn it for 4 days with no complaints, his problem was more mental than material. We arranged for him to get a larger size, which he put on reluctantly. He also kept taking off his sunglasses, and not remembering where he had put them when the staff asked why he was not following standard guard protocol. Guard Saros. I hated the whole fucking experiment. I walked out the door when the experiment was over. It was too real for me. On the Quiet Rage of Guard Sadism. Doug 8612, in an interview he did later for a student-directed film on our study, eloquently compared the Stanford prison experiment with real prisons he had come to know as a staff member working in a California prison. The Stanford prison was a very benign prison situation, and it still caused the guards to become sadistic, prisoners to become hysterical, other prisoners to break out in hives. Here you have a benign situation, and it didn't work. It promoted everything a regular prison promotes. The guard role promotes sadism. The prisoner role promotes confusion and shame. Anybody can be a guard. It's harder to be on guard against the impulse to be sadistic. It's a quiet rage, malevolence you can keep down, but there's nowhere for it to go. It comes out sideways, sadistically. I think you do have more control as a prisoner. Everybody needs to experience being a prisoner. There are real prisoners I've met in jail who are people of exceptional dignity, who do not put down the guards, who are always respectful of the guards, who do not create in the guards a sadistic impulse, who could rise above the shame of the role. They know how to preserve their dignity in that situation. On the Nature of Prisons. Clay 416. The guards are as locked in as you are as prisoners. They just have the run of the cell block, but they have a locked door behind them which they can't open, and so really you're all together, and what you create together. Prisoners have no society of their own, and the guards don't have any society of their own. It's one thing, and it's hideous. Guard Saros. When a prisoner reacted violently toward me, I found that I had to defend myself, not as me, but as me the guard. He hated me as the guard. He was reacting to the uniform. I had no choice but to defend myself as a guard. It shocked me. I realized that I was just as much a prisoner as they were. I was just a reaction to their feelings. We were both crushed by the oppressiveness, but we, the guards, had an illusion of freedom. That's just what it was, an illusion. We all went in slaves to the money. The prisoners soon became slaves to us. As Bob Dylan sings in his song, George Jackson, sometimes the world seems like one big prison yard. Some of us are prisoners, the rest of us are guards. On Character Transformation in 6 Days. Revealing some of the statements made before the start of the experiment, and then again in our various daily records, we can see some fundamental transitions taking place in the mentality of the guards. A case in point is that of guard Chuck Burdan, in his own words, before, during, and after this experience. Prior to the experiment. As I am a pacifist and non-aggressive individual, I cannot see a time when I might guard and or maltreat other living things. I hope that I will be chosen as a prisoner rather than a guard. As an anti-establishment person, continually involved in non-conforming political and social behavior, I can foresee a time when I may have to fill the role of a prisoner, and I'm curious to see my capabilities in that direction. After guard orientation meeting. Buying uniforms at the end of the meeting confirms the game-like atmosphere of this thing. I doubt whether many of us share the expectations of seriousness that the experimenters seem to have. I'm feeling a certain amount of relief at being only an alternate. First day. My main fear at the outset of the experiment was that prisoners would see me as a real bastard, as a guard type, as all the things I am not, and not the way I envision myself. One of the reasons I have long hair is I don't want people to envision me in a manner that I am not. Feel sure that the prisoners will make fun of my appearance and evolve my first basic strategy. Mainly, not to smile at anything they say or do which would be admitting it's all only a game. I stay outside the cage while Hellman and the tall blonde guard finish serving dinner. They seem much more self-assured in their roles than I feel. As I'm bracing myself to enter, I check my sunglasses, pick up my club, which provides a certain power and security, and walk in. I set my mouth rigidly into a semi-scowl, determined to hold it there no matter what is said. At cell 3, I stop, and setting my voice hard and low, say to number 5486, "What are you smiling at?" "Nothing, Mr. Correctional Officer." "Well, see that you don't." As I walk off, I feel stupid. Second day. Walking from my car, I suddenly wanted people to notice my uniform. "Hey, look what I'm doing." 5704 asked for a cigarette and I ignored him, because I am a non-smoker and could not empathize. Meanwhile, since I was feeling empathetic towards 1037, I determined not to talk with him. Later on, I'm getting into the habit of hitting walls, chairs, and bars with the billy club to show my power. After we had count and lights out, Guard Hellman and I held a loud conversation about going home to our girlfriends and what we were going to do to them to irritate the prisoners. Third day, preparing for the first visiting night. After warning the prisoners not to make any complaints unless they wanted the visit terminated fast, we finally brought in the first parents. I made sure I was one of the guards on the yard, because this was my first chance for the type of manipulative power that I really like, being a very noticed figure with almost complete control over what is said or not. While the parents and prisoners sat in chairs, I sat on the end of the table, dangling my feet and contradicting anything I felt like. This was the first part of the experiment I was really enjoying. Prisoner 819 is being obnoxious and bears watching. Hellman, I both admire and dislike. As a guard, actor, he is fantastic, really getting into the sadism of the thing, and this bugs me. Fourth day. The psychologist, Craig Haney, rebukes me for handcuffing and blindfolding a prisoner before leaving the counseling office, and I resentfully reply that it is both necessary security and my business anyway. At home, I was having more and more trouble describing the reality of the situation. Fifth day. I harass Sarge, who continues to stubbornly over-respond to all commands. I have singled him out for special abuse, both because he begs for it and because I simply don't like him. The real trouble starts at dinner. The new prisoner, 416, refuses to eat his sausages. We throw him into the hole, ordering him to hold sausages in each hand. We have a crisis of authority, This rebellious conduct potentially undermines the complete control we have over the others. We decide to play upon prisoner solidarity and tell the new one that all the others will be deprived of visitors if he does not eat his dinner. I walk by and slam my stick into the hole door. I'm very angry at this prisoner for causing discomfort and trouble for the others. I decided to force-feed him, but he wouldn't eat. I let the food slide down his face. I didn't believe it was me doing it. I hated myself for making him eat, but I hated him more for not eating. Sixth day. The experiment is over. I feel elated, but am shocked to find some other guards disappointed somewhat because of the loss of money and some because they are enjoying themselves. Talking during the detoxification session was very difficult. Everything seems strained and uncomfortable. I get on my bike and ride home through the sunshine. It feels damn good to be out of there. Weeks later. The absolute cruelty of this event, Hellman's decision to leave 416 in the hole all night, does not hit me until weeks later, but it must have hit Phil Zimbardo hard along with many other things at this point that he decided to end the study. Another curious character transformation of someone only tangentially associated with our study is found among additional anecdotes in the warden's log. Recall my serious psychologist colleague who challenged me in the midst of my frantic efforts to deceive the anticipated intruders by alleging the study had been terminated. He demanded to know, what is the independent variable? Jaffe's notes indicate that Dr. B visited on Tuesday night when the prisoners had been moved to the fifth floor closet. He and his wife went upstairs to see the prisoners. Mrs. B passed out cupcakes, while Dr. B made at least two comments ridiculing the prisoners, one concerning their manner of dress and the other concerning the stench of the place. This pattern of getting into the act occurred with almost every outside visitor. While his wife gave the participants some tea and sympathy, my usually reserved colleague unexpectedly treated these students in a dehumanized way that likely made them feel shamed. On Hellman's Little Experiments. Let's look back at the volunteer background form that Hellman completed a week before the start of the experiment in order to get a sense of what he was like in his pre-guard status. I was amazed to learn that he was only an 18-year-old sophomore student among our youngest participants. His counterpart, Arnett, was one of the oldest. Hellman came from a middle-class academic family, the youngest sibling of four older sisters and a brother. At 6'2" and 175 pounds, with green eyes and blonde hair, he was an imposing figure. This young man identified himself as a musician and a scientist at heart. His self-description indicated, "I live a natural life and love music and food and other people." He added, "I have a great love for my fellow human beings." In response to the question, "What do people like most about you?" Hellman radiated confidence. "People at first admire me because of my talent and outgoing personality. Few know my real capabilities at human relationships." In response to the negative version, "What do people like least about you?" Hellman gave us an insight into this young man's complex character and a hint of what is to come when he is given absolute power. He wrote, "My impatience with stupidity, a total disregard for people whose lifestyle I do not agree with. My exploitation of some people, my bluntness, my confidence." Finally, let's add to the mix that this volunteer said that he preferred to be assigned to the prisoner role rather than to be a guard because people resent guards. With that character reference in mind, it is now instructive to review his post-experiment reflections on what he perceived his role was in this study. Guard Hellman. "Yes, it has been more than an experiment. I had a chance at testing people's capabilities, pushing them to the breaking point under the guise of a correctional officer. It was not pleasant, but I felt compelled, out of my own fascination, to test their reactions. I was conducting experiments on my own, on many occasions. The best thing about the experiment was that I seemed to be the catalyst that brought out some startling results that gained interest from TV and the press. I'm sorry if I caused more trouble than you wanted. It was an experiment of my own. The worst thing about the experiment was that so many people took me so seriously, and that I made them enemies. My words affected them. The prisoners seemed to lose touch with the reality of the experiment. A month after our study was terminated, this former guard was interviewed along with former prisoner Clay, 416, his nemesis. They interacted as part of a TV documentary about our study on NBC's Chronologue, a forerunner of 60 Minutes. It was titled, 819 Did a Bad Thing. After Hellman described his transformation into the guard role, Clay went on the offensive, finally being able to add to the adage of that era, what comes around goes around. Hellman, once you put a uniform on and are given a role, I mean a job, saying, your job is to keep these people in line, then you're certainly not the same person if you're in street clothes and in a different role. You really become that person once you put on the khaki uniform, you put on the glasses, you take the nightstick, and you act the part. That's your costume, and you have to act accordingly when you put it on. Clay. It harms me. I mean harms. I mean in the present tense, it harms me. Hellman. How did it harm you? How does it harm you? Just to think that people can be like that? Clay. Yeah. It let me in on some knowledge that I've never experienced firsthand. I've read about it. I've read a lot about it. But I've never experienced it firsthand. I've never seen anyone turn that way. And I know that you're a nice guy, you know? You understand? Hellman, smiling and shaking his head. You don't know that. Clay. I do. I do know that you're a nice guy. I don't get bad. Hellman. Then why do you hate me? Clay. Because I know what you can turn into. I know what you're willing to do if you say, oh, well, I'm not going to hurt anybody. Oh, well, it's a limited situation. Or, it's over in 2 weeks. Hellman. Well, you in that position, what would you have done? Clay. Slowly and carefully enunciating each word. I don't know. I can't tell you that I know what I'd do. Hellman. Would you? Clay, now talking over Hellman. I don't think, I don't believe, I would have been as inventive as you. I don't think I would have applied as much imagination to what I was doing. Do you understand? Hellman. Yes, I. Clay. Interrupting and seeming to enjoy his new sense of power. I think I would have been a guard. I don't think it would have been such a masterpiece. Hellman. I didn't see where it was really harmful. It was degrading, and that was part of my particular little experiment to see how I could, Clay, in disbelief. Your particular little experiment? Why don't you tell me about that? Hellman. I was running little experiments of my own. Clay. Tell me about your little experiments. I'm curious. Hellman. Okay. I wanted to see just what kind of verbal abuse that people can take before they start objecting, before they start lashing back under the circumstances. And it surprised me that no one said anything to stop me. No one said, geez, you can't say those things to me. Those things are sick. Nobody said that. They just accepted what I said. I said, go tell that man to his face that he's the scum of the earth. And they'd do it without question. They'd do push-ups without question. They'd sit in the hole, they'd abuse each other, and here they're supposed to be together as a unit in jail, but here they're abusing each other because I requested them to, and no one questioned my authority at all. And it really shocked me. His eyes get teary. Why didn't people say something when I started to abuse people? I started to get so profane, and still, people didn't say anything. Why? Why, indeed?